talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
The opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network. Broadcasting to the world.
Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
Time, but space is a place that only a human being locates. Where there's so much information to take, then you enter an entirely new phase. Once you get off the internet, become World Wide Web.
Welcome to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind. I'm your host and facilitator, Junius Ricardo Stanley, inviting you to stay tuned for interesting interviews, news you can use, and programming designed with you in mind. Free your mind, the rest will follow, right here on the Cyberspace Sanctuary, on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul.
Cyberspace is the place. Cyberspace is the place.
Howard is asked, the question is it safe? Expediency asks, the question is it politics? Vanity asks, the question is it popular? The conscience asks, the question is it right? There comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe, nor politic, nor popular, but he must do it because conscience tells him it is right.
You're listening to the Cyberspace Sanctuary on the Blake Radio Network with Junius Ricardo Stanton. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Cyberspace Sanctuary. We call it a safe house for your mind. On the Blake Radio Network's Rainbow Soul with your host and facilitator, Junius Ricardo Stanton. We thank you for logging on. We thank you for trusting us to provide you interesting, thought-provoking, and informative programming. And that is our pledge and that is our promise. And we thank you for your trust and your confidence that we will honor our commitment to ourselves and to our community. We started off the program with a snippet, a soundbite from Martin Luther King Jr. talking about the importance of conscience and following one's conscience no matter the situation. And that is an apt beginning because today's program is going to center around Martin Luther King as we pay homage to him, his natal day, his life, and his legacy. So don't go anywhere. We have a very informative and thought-provoking program for you today, and we'll resume our programming following these messages. Don't go anywhere. You're logged on to Rainbow Soul on the Blake Radio Network. The name of this program is the Cyberspace Sanctuary. My name is Junius Ricardo Stanton. Stay tuned.
Greetings to the Internet Radio family. This is Reverend Valentine speaking. You know, for nearly 30 years, I have had the distinct experience of being interviewed over every medium of communication available to the public. And except for the metaphysical underground, I can think of no other electronic venue that has been more progressive, more innovative, more insightful, more diligent, more diverse in its demographics, and more courageously supportive of the truth than this ever-growing phenomenon called Internet radio. And this is precisely why I'm here to tell you that it is so vital that you give your wholehearted support to it. Tell a friend. In fact, tell two, three, and four of your friends. If you are a business owner, support Internet Radio by telling your customers and constituents all about it. Let them know that there is a legitimate and important substitute to all of the prefabricated, super-censored garbage polluting our public airways today. Don't allow the mass media to continue to treat you like a mindless consumer drone. Enhance your awareness. Indulge your critical thinking, your reasoning, and your analysis. Do as I do. Log on, listen in, and then let it be known all about your internet radio experience. Chimatep, beloved family, thank you for listening. Walk in light.
We'd like to welcome everybody checking in from Real Media Player, from Windows Media Player, from iTunes. We want to encourage everyone to log into our website, which is blakeradio.com, and become familiar with how you can access our broadcast directly from our website. And vice versa, those of you who check in directly from the Blake Radio Network, become familiar with how you can also access us through Real Media Player, through Windows Media Player, and iTunes by logging into their radio tuner guides and doing a search for us in the talk radio genre. You're listening to Rainbow Soul, talk radio at its best.
Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul.
Hi, I'm Junius Ricardo Stanton, inviting you to join me in financially supporting the Blake Radio Network on a regular basis. We need your continuing patronage to help the Blake Radio Network remain alive and thriving both now and well into the future. There are several easy ways you can send your contribution. To use PayPal, click on the help link on the Blake Radio Network's website at www.blakeradio.com. Or you can go directly to the PayPal website and click the send money link. Type in rainbowsoul@blakeradio.com as the email address, and Unlimited Ventures as the payee. Then follow the instructions. To send a check or money order, make it out to Unlimited Ventures, care of Neil Blake, and mail it to 73 Ireland Place, that's Ireland Place, Suite 109, Amityville, Amityville, New York, 11701. It's easy, painless, and uncomplicated. And you'll feel great after doing it, knowing you're keeping the Blake Radio Network alive and on the cutting edge of media technology. I'm Junius Ricardo Stanton, thanking you in advance for your support.
Gracious Professor Griff, you're listening to Junius Ricardo Stanton. Straight up, we're teaching you all those things you need to know from the neck up, all right? We're definitely doing a checkup from the neck up. This is Professor Griffin, Public Enemy, the ex-minister. I'm out. Peace.
A time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us, even when pressed by the demands of inner truth. Men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. And I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. What do they think as we test out our latest weapons on them, just as the Germans tested out new medicine and new tortures in the concentration camps of Europe? Now that is little left to build on save bitterness. We are met by deep but understandable mistrust. To speak for them is to explain this lack of confidence in Western words, and especially their distrust of American intentions now. The world now demands a maturity of America that we may not be able to achieve. This way of settling differences is not just. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. Somehow this madness must cease. We must stop now. I speak as one who loves America. To the leaders of our own nation, the great initiative in this war is ours. The initiative to stop it must be ours.
As we said earlier, today's program will focus on the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He's one of the most misunderstood and misrepresented and deliberately misrepresented icons of our time. I remember on Blake Radio Rainbow Soul, Dr. Mano Ampin did an outstanding series of lectures on Martin Luther King, his meaning to the struggle, and his significance. And I certainly don't intend to cover the same ground as Professor Mano Ampin, but I want to share some additional pieces as well as some of his biographical background. Because, like I said, Martin Luther King has been misrepresented deliberately by the ruling elites and the powers that be to denigrate him as a activist and a change agent. They want to cast him as a dreamer, as someone who had lofty ideals and vision, and he did. But he also challenged the greatest empire on the planet during his time, the United States Empire, and for that they eliminated him. Martin Luther King Jr. was born on January 15, 1929. He was murdered on April 4, 1968. He was born Michael Luther King Jr., but later had his name changed to Martin. He grew up in Atlanta during the time of racial apartheid and terror. He lived a relatively comfortable life. His grandfather was a minister. His paternal grandfather was a minister. His father was a minister and pastor who succeeded his father as pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta. Martin was somewhat of a boy genius, graduated high school very early and entered Morehouse. And upon his earning his degree, he went from Morehouse to Crozer Theological Seminary in Chester, PA. And, of course, there he continued, and then he began to study additionally, and then he went to Boston University. And while there, he met his wife-to-be, Coretta Scott. She was an artist and actress, and they hit it off well, and they got married. In 1954, Dr. King, who by then had gotten his doctorate, was called to become the pastor of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. And he was always very adroit. He studied under Benjamin Mays in Morehouse, and Dr. Mays challenged his students to be involved, to be engaged intellectually as well as socially in the life in their community, and Martin took him up on this. And early on, he was impressed with liberation. He attended the ceremonies when, I believe it was Ghana, was granted its independence. I'm sure that had a major impression upon him. He studied Thoreau and Gandhi as social activists, reformers, and change agents, and ultimately synthesized a philosophy using Gandhi's as well as Thoreau's resistance to immoral and illegal laws. Thoreau went to jail because he refused to pay taxes to support a government that was suppressing and oppressing the Native Americans. They had just passed the Indian Removal Act. He opposed it. He refused to pay taxes, so he was jailed. Gandhi used Thoreau, who was a philosopher and metaphysician's ideas to bring down the rule of a foreign government, the British Empire in India. King looked at their philosophies, studied their philosophies, and used a synthesis of that and applied it to the particulars of American apartheid, American terrorism, American racism in the Deep South. Shortly after he went to Montgomery, there was an incident where a young lady who was an activist herself in her own right, Rosa Parks, refused to give up her seat on a bus, which the laws of Montgomery and Alabama at that time demanded that if the bus were full, a black person would have to give up their seat to a white person, and she refused. Now, this was not just the act of a tired seamstress. She had been trained. She had gone through orientation, and she was committed to bringing change. If you dig into Rosa Parks' background, there's a lot of unpublished or unpopularized aspects of her early life that when you see them, you understand why she did what she did. It wasn't just that she was tired that day. She had prepped herself. She was in preparation and readiness for just such a time to take on that challenge. As a result of her arrest, because of her stature in the community, the citizens of Montgomery rallied, and they formed an organization, subsequently formed an organization called the Montgomery Improvement Association, and they used her arrest to challenge the segregated laws in transportation. And what we're going to share is one of the first meetings that Dr. King spoke, the very first meeting in Montgomery, Alabama, in December 5th, to be exact, 1955. Because he was new in town, because he did not have any ties to the community, they elected Martin Luther King to be the spokesperson for the Montgomery Improvement Association. Now, the religious leaders of the day, of the town, backed him, but because a lot of them had standing in the community and had ties with the white establishment, and King did not. He was brand new, relatively new. They elected him, and he assumed the mantle as the spokesperson and galvanized a group of people who were waiting for such an opportunity. Like I said, it wasn't just random happenstance. They were waiting. In fact, there were incidences prior to Rosa Parks where a young girl attempted to do the same thing, but the movement fell apart because she was very young, and she had some issues in terms of her background that they felt could be used against her. And the authorities really didn't press it. And so those people who were waiting in the wings to have an incident to spring to action chose not to focus on the young girl. And then when Mrs. Parks did what she did, because of her stature, because of her training, that became the spark that set off the civil rights movement officially in the United States. Now, there are other people who say that the killing of Emmett Till brought matters to a head, and the fact that his mother refused, once his body was found, refused to have a closed casket funeral, that the world saw his mutilated, mangled body, that just made black people in the South have what I call a Popeye moment. You know, that's all as I can stand, and I can't stand no more. So it was percolating under the surface. But we're going to share with you one of the first speeches that King makes, and listen to his language. Now, keep in mind, he was very erudite. He was educated. He went to college when he was 15, and so he was used to elocution. Like I said, he studied under Benjamin Mays and a lot of other intellectual giants at the various institutions that he attended. But he was able to break it down to working class folks. Now, they weren't all poor. They weren't all cotton pickers or cotton choppers or whatever. A lot of them were domestics, but a lot of them worked in some of the factories around. So they were relatively well off. I mean, they didn't get the same pay that the Euro-Americans got, but they were doing fairly well, all things considered. So we're going to listen to, in this segment, a speech that he delivers, one of the early speeches he delivers to an assemblage of the Montgomery Improvement Association.
We are certainly very happy to see each of you out this evening. We are here this evening for serious business. We are here in a general sense because first and foremost, we are American citizens. And we are determined to acquire our citizenship to the fullness of its meaning. We're here also because of our love for democracy. Because of our deep-seated belief that democracy transformed from thin paper to thick action is the greatest form of government on earth. But we are here in a specific sense because of the bus situation in Montgomery. We are here because we are determined to get the situation corrected. This situation is not at all new. The problem has existed over endless years. For many years now, Negroes in Montgomery and so many other areas have been inflicted with the paralysis of crippling fear on buses in our community. So many occasions, Negroes have been intimidated, humiliated, and oppressed, because of the sheer fact that they were Negroes. I don't have time this evening to go into the history of these numerous cases. Many of them now are lost in the thick fog of oblivion. But at least one stands before us now with glaring dimensions. Just the other day, just last Thursday to be exact, one of the finest citizens in Montgomery, not one of the finest Negro citizens, but one of the finest citizens in Montgomery, was taken from a bus and carried to jail and arrested because she refused to get up to give her seat to a white person. Now the press would have us believe that she refused to leave a reserve exception for Negroes. But I want you to know this evening that there is no reserve exception. The man has never been qualified at that point. Now I think I speak with legal authority. Not that I don't have any legal authority, but I think I speak with legal authority behind me. That the law, the ordinance, the city ordinance, has never been totally clarified. Mrs. Rosa Parks is a fine person. And since it had to happen, I'm happy that it happened to a person like Mrs. Parks. And nobody can doubt the boundless outreach of her integrity. Nobody can doubt the height of her character. Nobody can doubt the depth of her Christian commitment and devotion to the teachings of Jesus. And I'm happy since it had to happen. It happened to a person that nobody can call a disturbing factor in the community. Mrs. Parks is a fine Christian person, unassuming, and yet there is integrity and character there. And just because she refused to get up, she was arrested. You know, my friends, there comes a time when people get tired of being trampled over by the iron feet of oppression.
Justice is a lie.
must stick together. Unity is the great need of the hour. And if we are united, we can get many of the things that we not only desire, but which we justly deserve. Don't let anybody fight you. We are not afraid of what we are doing, because we are doing it within the law. There is never a time in our American democracy that we must ever think we are wrong when we protest. We reserve that right. When labor all over this nation came to see that it would be trampled over by capitalistic power, it was nothing wrong with labor getting together and organizing and protesting for its rights. We, the disinherited of this land, we who have been oppressed so long, a tired of burning through the long night of captivity, now we are reaching out for the daybreak of freedom and justice and equality. May I say to you, my friends, as I come to a close, just giving some idea of why we are assembled here, that we must keep, and I want to stress this, and all of our doings and all of our deliberations here this evening and all of the week and while, whatever we do, we must keep right in the forefront. Let us be Christian in all of our actions. But I want to tell you this evening that it is not enough for us to talk about love. Love is one of the pivotal parts of the Christian faith. There is another side called justice. And justice is really love in calculation. Justice is love correcting that which revolts against law. The Almighty God Himself is not the God just standing out saying through Hosea, I love you, Israel. He's also the God that stands up before the nations and says, be still and know that I'm God. That if you love a baby on him, break the backbone of your power. Knock you out of the orbit of your international and national relationship. Standing beside love is always just. And we are only using the tools of justice. Not only are we using the tools of persuasion, but we've come to see that we've got to use the tools of coercion. Not only is this thing a process of education, but it is also a process of legislation. As we stand and sit here this evening, and as we prepare ourselves for what lies ahead, let us go out with the grim and bold determination that we are going to stick together.
The ministers in Montgomery, as well as some of the civic leaders and some of the business folks, galvanized the community. The community supported what they were doing. They instituted a boycott of the transportation system. It lasted for 380-some days, well over a year. Despite threats, despite intimidation, despite violence, they hung tough. They stayed unified. And they brought not only the city, but the bus company to their knees, because the boycott was having an adverse impact on the downtown community. Not only wasn't the transportation company getting money, because a lot of the people worked and they didn't have cars, so they used the transportation company to get back and forth as domestics to the factories and to wherever they were going. So the people organized. Not only did they have rallies to keep the people's spirits up, the morale up, they organized carpools. They had all kinds of sophisticated arrangements where people would be picked up, taken to work, so that those who continued to work, and because a lot of them were threatened, the whites threatened a lot of the domestics and a lot of the other workers, if they participated, they would lose their job. So a lot of them actually lost their job because they refused to back down. That's how powerful the movement was. That's how energized they were. And so they were able to come together because they were already living in a segregated community. Now, everybody didn't participate. I mean, you hear the stories of Condoleezza Rice, her parents. She was in the South. They did not participate. So there was a segment of Negroes who refused to participate, and they were fairly well off. You know, mother was a school teacher and father had some kind of job. So they were kind of bougie. But for the most part, the black community rallied to such a point that during that whole time, during that 386 days, the crime rate in the black community plummeted, just came down, because everybody was hyped, everybody was up on it. And not only were the bus company executives concerned, but the downtown people, even though it was segregated, where people would have to eat at the back or just go back to a back window, or whatever, folks stopped supporting. It was selective patronage and a boycott. It was bringing the city to its knees. And that's one of the lessons of the Montgomery bus boycott. And as a result of their success, Martin Luther King, the leaders of the Montgomery Improvement Association, got a reputation. So other communities in Alabama started calling them for support. Birmingham called him. They responded. They went there, addressed the issues there. Now, because of the Montgomery success, the U.S. Supreme Court took up the issue in conjunction with the NAACP, which was, remember, this was right after Brown versus Topeka Board of Education. That was 54. This was 55. They're on a roll, but the resistance was the pushback. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So the pushback of the status quo was immense. They called them. They went to Birmingham. There was even pushback amongst the Negro clergy. And as a result, King's father and his helped form the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to get around the stranglehold that the National Baptist Convention had on, and its president had on, the Baptist. Southern Christian Leadership Conference that King became the head of in 1957 reached out and became ecumenical in terms of reaching across denominational lines, circumventing the reach of Jackson, who had been the head of the National Black Baptist Convention. There had been several attempts to unseat him and get out, and in fact there was a splinter group called the National Progressive Convention, but none had the range and the reach and the support of the SCLC. The SCLC was able to galvanize the support of Europeans, Euro-Americans, and working in conjunction, sometimes in competition with groups like the Urban League and NAACP, the SCLC became one of the bulwark of the civil rights organization. King gained notoriety when he was given the Nobel Peace Prize because of his espousal of nonviolence and that the tactics he learned from Gandhi worked. And because of how they use particularly young people in Birmingham, the school children, was quite effective because the young medium of television captured that, and they captured it in a way, and it was presented in a way that created sympathy for the movement. It became obvious that the laws were immoral. Now all of a sudden the United States is not looking too good, so that's one of the reasons there was a change, a movement. I mean, because the United States internationally was moving to take up the mantle of global white supremacy around the world, and they couldn't go out there saying that they're for peace, that they're for freedom, they're for equality and justice. And you're seeing dogs being unleashed on school children, fire hoses, tanks, and armored cars being used to stop people who were peaceably demonstrating. So that created a conundrum and a dilemma for the powers that be. There was really no change of heart, a change of mind. They just had to change tactics and make some concessions. And that's what they began to do, particularly as the NAACP and Thurgood Marshall and his team, the legal defense team, was battering the doors down, not only in the Supreme Court, but in the state and federal court. They were winning back-to-back major victories. And the direct action of people like Martin Luther King, whether it was in Birmingham or as they gained stature and he began to come north, he came to Philadelphia and he partnered and hooked up with a very popular radio personality, DJ Georgie Woods, and he became famous because he had ties to the community, because he had went to school in Chester and he'd been up there, and because of the ministerial network with his father, a lot of the Philadelphia churches, pastors, they looked out for him. You know, he got speaking engagements and things like that. So he had entree into Philly, and he tried to parley that and leverage that in other places. Didn't work out too well, particularly like in Chicago and maybe New York. As he grew in stature, so did the consciousness of black people. And the thing is, while he was doing what he was doing, the young people, in addition to the sit-in movements and what was going down at North Carolina A&T, and as it spread throughout the South, it was this synergistic movement and this energy. Like I said, it was like black people had said, enough is enough, that's all as I can stand, and I can't stand no more. And it was just, the lids were coming off. To his credit, King kept growing, kept evolving. Once he stepped outside of the South, he began to see conditions in the urban centers in the North. And with the riots in Newark and Watts, that set off even greater urgency and a greater sense of tension and pushback from the system. Of course, then he began to deal with other issues, which set him even further apart. He began to speak out about what was going on in the North, but then he internationalized the struggle. Malcolm X had done that before, and they were contemporaries. Malcolm was doing it and attempting to bring the United States before the world court on charges of war crimes and genocide and crimes against humanity, which would have further diminished the image of the United States, the propaganda that they were putting out there about America being so great and so free and so the home of the brave, et cetera, et cetera. And King also evolved. He saw the connection. Because we were in a war footing, and their goal was to keep America in a war footing, if you were a radical, you were a communist, you were un-American. And that's when the Congress and the Senate had their House Select Committee on Un-American Activities, and the Senate had a similar sham program of intimidation and terrorism. So everybody became a communist. So, you know, that's the forerunner of what we're currently going through now, where anybody who speaks up now is a terrorist. And so he attacked the Vietnam War. And we're going to listen to parts of a speech that he gave 1 year to the day before he was killed. And it's entitled, Why I Opposed the Vietnam War.
The time has come for America to hear the truth about this tragic war. Now, I've chosen to preach about the war in Vietnam today because I agree with Dante that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in a period of moral crisis, maintain their neutrality. There comes the time when silence is betrayal. The truth of these words is beyond doubt, but the mission to which they call us is the most difficult one. Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. Nor does the human spirit move without great difficulty against all the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom. There has never been such a monumental dissent during a war by the American people. Polls reveal that almost 15 million Americans explicitly oppose the war in Vietnam. Additional millions cannot bring themselves around to support it. This reveals that millions have chosen to move beyond the prophesying of smooth patriotism to the high grounds of firm dissent based upon the mandates of conscience and the reading of history. Now, of course, one of the difficulties in speaking out today grows out of the fact that there are those who are seeking to equate dissent with disloyalty. It's a dark day in our nation when high-level authorities will seek to use every method to silence dissent. Something is happening and people are not going to be silenced. The truth must be told. And I say that those who are seeking to make it appear that anyone who opposes the war in Vietnam is a fool or a traitor or an enemy of our soldiers is a person who has taken a stand against the best in our tradition. Many persons have questioned me about the wisdom of my path. Why are you speaking about the war, Dr. King? Why are you joining the voices of dissent? Peace and civil rights don't mix, they say. And so this morning I speak to you on this issue because I am determined to take the gospel seriously. There is at the outset a very obvious an almost facile connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle I and others have been waging in America. A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. Then came the build-up in Vietnam, and I watched the program broken as if it were some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor, so long as adventures like Vietnam continued to draw men and skills and money like some demonic destructive suction tube. And you may not know it, my friends, but it is estimated that we spend $500,000 to kill each enemy soldier, while we spend only $53 for each person classified as poor. And much of that $53 goes for salaries to people who are not poor. So I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and attack it as such. Perhaps the more tragic recognition of reality took place when it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and die in extraordinarily high proportion relative to the rest of the population. We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Harlem. So we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schoolroom. So we watch them in brutal solidarity burning the huts of a poor village. But we realize that they would hardly live on the same block in Chicago or Atlanta. As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems. And I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. America and most of its newspapers applauded me in Montgomery, and I stood before thousands of Negroes getting ready to riot when my home was bombed, and said, "We can't do it this way." They applauded us in the sit-in movement, and we nonviolently decided to sit in at lunch counters. They applauded us on the freedom rides when we accepted blows without retaliation. Oh, the press was so noble in its applause and so noble in its praise when I was saying, "Be nonviolent toward Bull Connor." There's something strangely inconsistent about a nation and a press that will praise you when you say, "Be nonviolent toward Jim Clark," but will curse and damn you when you say, "Be nonviolent toward little brown Vietnamese children." There's something wrong with that press. Another burden of responsibility was placed upon me in 1964. And I cannot forget that the Nobel Peace Prize was not just something taking place, but it was a commission a commission to work harder than I had ever worked before for the brotherhood of man. This is a calling that takes me beyond national allegiances, but even if it were not present, I would yet have to live with the meaning of my commitment to the ministry of Jesus Christ. To me, the relationship of this ministry to the making of peace is so obvious that I sometimes marvel at those who ask me why I am speaking against the war. Could it be that they do not know that the good news was meant for all men, for communists and capitalists, for their children and ours, for black and white, for revolutionary and conservative? Have they forgotten that my ministry is in obedience to the one who loved his enemies so fully that he died for them? What then can I say to the Viet Cong or to Castro or to Mao as a faithful minister to Jesus Christ? Can I threaten them with death? Or must I not share with them my life? There will be no meaningful solution until some attempt is made to know these people and hear their broken cries. And who are we supporting in Vietnam today? It's a man by the name of General Key, who fought with the French against his own people, and who said on one occasion that the greatest hero of his life is Hitler. This is who we are supporting in Vietnam today. Oh, our government and the press generally won't tell us these things, but God told me to tell you this morning. The truth must be told. And all the while the people read our leaflets and received regular promises of peace and democracy and land reform. Now they languish under our bombs and consider us, not their fellow Vietnamese, the real enemy. They see the children degraded by our soldiers as they beg for food. We have destroyed their two most cherished institutions, the family and the village. We have destroyed their land and their crops. This is the role our nation has taken. The role of those who make peaceful revolutions impossible by refusing to give up the privileges and the pleasures that comes from the immense profits of overseas investments. Now, I'm convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers' profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, militarism, and economic exploitation are incapable of being conquered. A true revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our present policies. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth with righteous indignation. It will look across the seas and see individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money in Asia, Africa, and South America, only to take the profits out with no concern for the social betterment of the countries, and say this is not just. It will look at our alliance with the landed gentry of Latin America and say this is not just. The Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just. A true revolution of values will lay hands on the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just. this business of burning human beings with napalm, of filling our nation's homes and with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of peoples normally humane, of sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields, physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. And it is a sad fact that because of comfort complacency, a morbid fear of communism, our proneness to adjust to injustice, the Western nations that initiated so much of the revolutionary spirit of the modern world have now become the arch anti-revolutionaries. Our only hope today lies in our ability to recapture the revolutionary spirit and go out into a sometimes hostile world, declaring eternal hostility to poverty, racism, and militarism. A genuine revolution of values means, in the final analysis, that our loyalties must become ecumenical rather than sectional. Every nation must now develop an overriding loyalty to mankind as a whole in order to preserve the best in their individual societies. This calls for a worldwide fellowship that lifts the neighborly concern beyond one's tribe, race, class, and nation is in reality a call for an all-embracing, unconditional love for all men. This oft misunderstood and misinterpreted concept, so readily dismissed by the Nietzsches of the world as a weak and cowardly force, has now become an absolute necessity for the survival of mankind. Let me say finally that I oppose the war in Vietnam because I love America. I speak out against this war not in anger, but with anxiety and sorrow in my heart, and above all with a passionate desire to see our beloved country stand as the moral example of the world. I speak out against this war because I'm disappointed with America. And there can be no great disappointment where there is no great love. I'm disappointed with our failure to deal positively and forthrightly with the triple evils of racism, economic exploitation, and militarism. We are presently moving down a dead-end road that can lead to national disaster. America has strayed to the far country of racism and militarism. All men are made in the image of God. All men are brothers. All men are created equal. Every man is an heir to a legacy of dignity and worth. Every man has rights that are neither conferred by nor derived from the state. They are God-given. Out of one blood, God made all men to dwell upon the face of the earth. What a marvelous foundation for any home. What a glorious and healthy place to inhabit. But America strayed away, and this unnatural excursion has brought only confusion and bewilderment. It has left hearts aching with guilt and minds distorted with irrationality. It is time for all people of conscience to call upon America to come back home. Come home, America. I call on Washington today. I call on every man and woman of goodwill all over America today. I call on the young men of America who must make a choice today. Take a stand on this issue. Tomorrow may be too late. And don't let anybody make you think that God chose America as his divine messianic force to be a sort of policeman of the whole world. God has a way of standing before the nations with judgment, and it seems that I can hear God saying to America, you are too arrogant. Now, it isn't easy to stand up for truth and for justice. Sometimes it means being frustrated when you tell the truth and take a stand. Sometimes it means losing a job. It means being abused and scorned. It may mean having a 7 or 8 year old child asking your daddy, why do you have to go to jail so much? But I've long since learned that to be a follower of Jesus Christ means taking up the cross. And my Bible tells me that Good Friday comes before Easter. Before the crown we wear, there is the cross that we must bear. Let us bear it. Bear it for truth. Bear it for justice. And bear it for peace. Let us go out this morning with that determination. And I have not lost faith. I'm not in despair. I haven't lost faith because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because the Bible is right. You shall reap what you sow. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when the lion and the lamb will lie down together, and every man will sit under his own vine and fig tree, and none shall be afraid, because the words of the Lord have spoken it. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when all over the world we will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last. With this faith, we'll sing it as we are getting ready to sing it now. Men will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. And nations will not rise up against nations, neither shall they study war anymore. And I don't know about you, I ain't gonna study war no more.
King's stance on the war made him very unpopular, made him persona non grata, fell from favor, if he ever was, in the Johnson administration. And of course, the country was going through numerous changes, and there was push, counter push. Like I said, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So you had the Black Power movement that challenged King and questioned his nonviolent tactics, said that the system wasn't adopting or moving quick enough. King was under pressure to produce results. The anti-war movement was growing. There was a plethora of other movements, the American Indian movement, the RASA, and the government went into full counterinsurgency mode with COINTELPRO and Operation Chaos, and they were just two of the programs that they initiated against the people and the various organizations. Some of the pretty benign. They range from the benign to the radical. And if you want to really understand how the police state became repressive and fascistic, do some research on the Church Committee on Abuses of Power. The CIA was so incensed with Church and I believe his House counterpart that they waged a war to prevent them from being reelected. So the same tactics they were using around the world to to influence and rig elections they did here in the United States. Unlike the Rockefeller Commission report, which was a whitewash, the Church Committee did a thorough investigation and thoroughly documented the abuses and shared a warning, a grave warning, about the dangers of such activities. But of course, the people didn't listen, and now we're seeing the same thing happening again. This is an extended version so we can address some of the issues about Martin Luther King Jr. Again, very misunderstood. I eschewed dealing with the March on Washington because I subscribe to Malcolm's take on that when he talked about it, his speech in Detroit a couple of days before the march, where he talked about how the various foundations and so-called liberal leaders had put an agenda together for the march. There was a lot of jostling behind the scenes. It was really gross hypocrisy and mendacity, because they got the United Auto Workers and some of the other unions, when in fact a lot of the trade unions still had white-only clauses, still were preventing people of color, particularly African Americans, from joining the unions. But they were out front in the march in Washington, D.C., and of course, the speech was very profound. It's just that they only shared the last half. He talked about a promissory note. He talked about how the United States had forfeited and had reneged on his promise, and that they'd written a check and it came back marked insufficient funds, and it was very critical. But then he morphed into the hopeful part of it, which is the part that they play all the time, and they keep him locked into that framework in 1963, when clearly he evolved into a much deeper thinker and he understood fully the implications of U.S. domestic and foreign policy, which brings us to the point of my latest piece, and you can see it at Seeing Black and some of the other listservs. It's entitled "The King Legacy Still Lives," and you can see it at seeingblack.com under my blog, From the Ramparts. Dr. King's legacy lives. Quote, "The hope of a secure and livable world lies with disciplined nonconformists who are dedicated to justice, peace, and brotherhood," unquote, Martin Luther King Jr. When I first heard about the call to occupy Wall Street several months ago, I immediately thought about Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s Poor People's Campaign. In case you were too young to remember, in 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. was planning a massive nationwide poor people's campaign to draw attention to the class warfare raging in the country at that time. He was attempting to organize and galvanize hundreds of thousands of poor and working class people of all colors to amass on Washington, D.C. The goal was to encamp in the nation's capital to apply pressure on Congress to stop the imperialist wars in Indochina, focus more attention on the plight of the poor and suffering in this country, and redirect governmental resources on their behalf. At the same time he was getting the Poor People's Campaign off the ground, King lent his support to the striking sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee. These workers were attempting to unionize, gain the respect and recognition of the city administration, to negotiate in good faith for fair and decent wages and the right for collective bargaining. To me, the call to occupy Wall Street struck a similar chord, and their activism reminded me of King's earlier efforts. I was pleased to see activism and resistance bloom in the midst of the current political and economic climate. The Occupy Wall Street movement was a call to direct action. Too much emphasis has been placed today on armchair activism, social networking, writing letters, calling legislators, and community service. Time has come to do more. Time has come for decisive direct action, civil disobedience, strikes, and demonstrations to challenge and right the wrongs of this society. Income inequality and corporate intrigue and influence is higher today than at any time in U.S. history since the robber baron era. To their credit, the young people behind the Occupy Wall Street movement did not elect to sit passively by and allow this form of fascism to go unchallenged and unchecked. Just like King challenged racial apartheid and economic injustice These young people are bringing economic apartheid and the class war to the public's consciousness. Martin Luther King Jr. was killed because the U.S. government and their corporate puppeteers feared his talk of economic apartheid would further radicalize the masses who were already waking up to how they were being duped, used, and ground up by the U.S. military-industrial complex. King was the most prominent and widely recognized clergyman to come out against the Vietnam War. None of the other well-known religious leaders of his day, Bishop Sheen, Billy Graham, Norman Vincent Peale, publicly uttered a word against the devastation and the carnage the U.S. was wreaking on Southeast Asia. King tied the war over there, the huge expenditures and profits being made by U.S. companies, to the economic privation in this country. King pointed out the direct correlation between the money spent on foreign wars and the failure of the government to address the poverty, hunger, and oppression here. King's stance gave a huge boost to the anti-war movement and put the government on the defensive, to the point it stepped up its counterinsurgency operation against the civil rights, anti-war, and other radical movements. The U.S. government initiated a reign of dirty tricks, terror, and violence against peace demonstrators, civil rights activists, the migrant worker movement, La Raza, Black Power, the American Indian movement, and numerous others. The FBI and CIA waged a vicious war against the American people in a fashion that would have made Adolf Hitler proud. COINTELPRO and Operation Chaos were just two of the government's more infamous programs to attack the people. Numerous lives were ruined by the government's wickedness, both here and overseas. King's grassroots direct action movement posed a major threat to the status quo, so the U.S. government killed him. Lo, 43 years later, we're seeing history repeat itself. The legacy of resistance to evil, war, and economic oppression still flickers. The original Tea Party, meaning the asymmetric, energetic, and unorganized group of protesters who were extremely concerned about the government, rising debt, taxes, the wars, and expanding costs of government, was a start of activism, but they were subsequently co-opted by the Koch brothers, who steered them into the Republican Party. The Occupy Wall Street movement saw this and refused to fall into the same trap. So they wisely kept the movement fluid with no identifiable, targetable spokespersons. They also eschewed dialogue with the powers that be. They were merely attempting to raise consciousness about the collusion and corruption between corporations and the government, corporate criminality, the wars, and the galloping fascism that is engrossing this country. If you stop and think about the original Tea Party activists and the young people in the Occupy Wall Street movement around the country are not that different from what Martin Luther King Jr. attempted, only they're doing it on a local level. So in this regard, Martin Luther King's legacy still lives. Alas, the government's response has been exactly the same. Co-option of the Tea Party, first ignoring, then using the media to demonize the Occupy Wall Street movement, and finally employing violence to squash the movement altogether. Instead of assassinating the leader or the leaders who they could not identify like they did King, they co-opted the Tea Party and then bum-rushed the OWS encampments, beating, pepper spraying, and arresting them. 4 decades ago, war criminals like Lyndon Johnson, Robert McNamara, Richard Nixon, and Henry Kissinger went scot-free. Today, it's the Wall Street banksters' turn to receive a get-out-of-jail-free card. The government is hoping the state's violence will discourage and deter future demonstrations and resistance against USA-style fascism. Congress just passed and Obama signed a draconian bill allowing indefinite detention without trial for U.S. citizens and ordered the opening and operation of FEMA internment camps. Time will tell if they have succeeded in dousing the fires of resistance. They may have added more fuel to the fire. Private gun sales are at an all-time high. As wrong and unjust as all this appears, rest assured, things are not as they seem. King understood the nature of progress and struggle. He once said, quote, "Human progress is neither automatic nor inevitable. Every step toward the goal of justice requires sacrifice, suffering, and struggle. The tireless exertions and passionate concern of dedicated individuals," unquote. So as we pause to reflect on and honor the real legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., let's not get duped and sidetracked with feel-good, once-a-year community service projects. These times demand more than that. Martin Luther King openly challenged the evil of racial apartheid, the wickedness of political oppression, the waste of war, and the immorality of economic injustice on a full-time, full-steam-ahead basis. We can do the same. And that's my piece from the Ramparts. Like I said, you can see it at seeingblack.com. And if you subscribe to some of the e-lists like Unite in Resistance Campaign, the Blacklist, Sons of Africa, you also see it there. So we need to reassess what's happening and don't allow the corporatist media and the gatekeepers and the status quo to turn him into some kind of idle dreamer, some kind of person who placated the status quo and honor him by doing community service. Yes, our communities need to be cleaned up, fixed up, but that's just addressing a symptomatic outcome of the cause of racism, militarism, economic apartheid. The system needs to be challenged. King challenged the system. He was not talking about community service. He challenged the system in Montgomery. He challenged the system in Birmingham. He challenged the system in Chicago. He challenged the system in Memphis. Now, some could say, well, that's what got him killed. But he said, if a man does not find something that he's worth dying for, he's not fit to live. And our ancestor said, better to be a martyred freedom fighter than live as a slave. And so we need to make up our minds and determine where we want to be and what we want to do and how we want to effect change and navigate our reality. Because there was a time when black people were the moral compass of this country, even in the muffled sense where they tried to suppress it. We stood out and spoke up against slavery. We fought for our own freedom. We resisted apartheid. It was the NAACP Legal Defense Fund under Thurgood Marshall that won victory after victory after victory in the struggle to dismantle racial and economic apartheid in this country, working along with Martin Luther King's direct action and several other people around the country who were able to force the government to make a choice. Now, again, like I said earlier in the program, their choice was determined not so much based on morality or doing the right thing, but also because they had an image to project as they attempted to carry the banner of global white supremacy around the world and exert themselves in the American empire. And so they had to make some concessions and some changes. Today, the covers and the veneer are coming off the notion that America is what its propaganda says it is. More and more people are seeing, particularly as this 2012 election cycle rolls out, that the United States is a banana republic. And people are seeing the absurdity of the whole notion that 400 and some people in Congress and 100 senators can actually represent 300 and some million people. I mean, it's preposterous. And they're seeing that not only is that whole system preposterous, and never was it intended to be that anyway. It was intended to represent the money class from day one, the oligopoly of the 18th century in the beginning. But now it's morphed into a totally fascist, meaning that the government is totally subservient to the corporatist elite. And so the question now becomes, what are we going to do about it? And only you and we can answer that question. And as we close out, take another look at Martin Luther King. Don't allow the corporatist media and our adversaries, those who want to enslave us in their wicked debt-based peonage system, to turn him into a caricature of what he really is and was. And so until next time, we say engage in mental decolonization. Free your mind. The rest will follow.
Cyberspace is a place that no army with artillery invades, where no military.
You've been listening to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind on the Blake Radio Network with Junius Ricardo Stanton. Thank you for logging on. We invite you to tune in again and engage in mental decolonization. Free your mind. The rest will follow.
That no corporation incorporates, no denomination faith dominates, and no court is going to try